It's now 8 o'clock. So time for this morning's talk. And today is Friday. And already almost a week has gone past. And some people are thinking, it's time to start packing. Please don't pack until the most 1 hour before you have to leave. Even better, half an hour before you leave. Because otherwise we're wasting so much time in our life. Always looking forward to our next destination. Sometimes wishing away days and weeks or even years of our life. We'll get out of this and then when we get back, we'll be where we want to be. And as soon as you're there, you want to be somewhere else. And it's amazing just how many people just always want to be somewhere else. Never where they are. And that's one of the problems in our life. There's always something else to do, somewhere else to go, something else to achieve. Which means we can never actually stay and be here and just realize just what is this thing which we call life, being in this moment. You don't find your truth tomorrow on the next destination. You always find it right here, in this moment. Just letting this moment be and allowing yourself just to be here rather than always going somewhere else. So you have 2 days left. That's 48 hours. That is 2,880 minutes. Is that right? Yeah, about that. 2,880 minutes, which is almost 160,000 seconds. 160,000! Moment you can become enlightened. Wow! You've got heaps of time. So don't worry, just go and take a rest. There's many times to get enlightened after this. But the point is that sometimes we don't just grab this moment, allow this moment to be, and learn from it. Which is one of the reasons we're always going somewhere else to do something else. And it's even if you have, just when you're waiting, just to get into the talk. It's always what I call the in-between moments of life. When you've left one destination, you haven't arrived at another destination. You've finished your chores, but it's not time for the talk. And there's so many of those wonderful moments in life, the in-between moments. You know, I left my hut after breakfast, and I haven't arrived on this seat yet. We've got time. And a lot of times, we waste those times. The in-between moments of life where you can just sit down, relax, watch the trees grow, or just check in, how's your body, how's your mind, and enjoy the fact that you haven't arrived yet, but you've left your destination, you left your origin, but now you're right here in these beautiful in-between moments of life. And those are the places where you find, I find, a lot of peace, a lot of wisdom, a lot of joy, just being on the journey rather than having arrived, having left somewhere and still not having got to the end. Times where you can have some fun and get some Dhamma, like just I was quietly sitting, minding my own business on the stupa, when, click, click, the paparazzi caught me. But I say you have to be much better paparazzi, because when I told this one gentleman who was a professional photographer for the Sunday Times newspaper here in Perth, he used to come mostly with his wife, but he used to hear some of those stories, especially that story of Ajahn Chah and the still forest pool. How Ajahn Chah had to be perfectly still. when the beautiful forest animals would come out to play. And if he moved even a little bit, the animals would know he was there and they would hide, because those animals were incredibly shy. And when he heard that story, he said that was one of the reasons he got the scoop of his life. Because nothing much happens in Western Australia, in Perth, but there was a rumour going around that the musician, a pop star, Kylie Minogue, had had some problems, some breakdown, and that she was hiding out in Cable Beach Resorts in Broome. And his editor said, would you like to go up to Cable Beach Resort just in case? That's one of the most beautiful parts of the world. He said, yeah, sure, no argument, I'm off. So off he went to Cable Beach Resort. And of course, no one knew if Kylie Minogue was there or not. Because no one would say she was, you know, just, if she was, she was just hiding out. So what he did with his camera gear, he climbed over the fence, crept through the bushes, and then he saw her. It was real. And he remembered, how can I take this photograph without her seeing me or hearing me? Because this is like a very experienced pop singer. I'm sure that, you know, she's been taught just know how to avoid the paparazzi. And he thought, ah, Ajahn Chah's simile of the still forest pool. So he had to lift up his camera and focus so mindfully, because he knew that if he made a noise, she would see and she would run away and the scoop of his life would be lost. And he told me that that simile was how he managed to actually to focus, click, click, and get the scoop. He said the most exciting time of his life. The only time he did anything which was interesting. And he thanked me. And sometimes I just wonder, was that really good karma on my part? That he was using this, which is supposed to be our like nimitas, not stars, to be able to see a nimitra, not interfere with it, so they don't know you're looking. But that's what he managed to do with Kylie Minogue. So there's many other benefits, unexpected benefits of learning deep meditation. But anyway, that whatever one does is those moments when instead of getting excited and just wasting time, one is right here and enjoys just this wonderful moment. Instead of saying, when am I going to get here? Or when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When am I going to stop going somewhere, wasting time, and always being up in the future somewhere? That's one of those other little stories which, you know, I sometimes tell. About, I figured this out when I was young. This is a story even from my youth before I became a monk. Because, you know, when I was young, I loved playing soccer in the streets. And when it came to about 14 or 15, it was a time to do your O-level exams. This was in England. And my teachers and my parents, my friends said, O-levels are really important. You do well in your O-levels, and then, you know, you'll be happy. And so I stopped playing football and just went to do my homework. You know what happened? I did well. I passed all my O-levels, got good grades too. So was I happy? No. Now I had to do A-levels, more work. But then, you know, that time I wasn't chasing a football anymore. I was chasing girls, and my mother, my father had died, and my mother and my other relations and friends and teachers, stop going out late at night, stay home, do your homework, you know, sacrifice a little bit, because if you pass your A-levels, then you can go to university, then you can do really well. So what did I do? I was very gullible. I believed what they said. And so I did really work hard. And I passed my A-levels, straight A's. So what happened? More work, university. And at the university, they said, well, look, you know, I know that you'd like to go out and just mess around and play around, but if you pass your degree at university, wow, and a good university like Cambridge, then you'll be set for life. You just, you know, work hard, do your homework, and then you'll be happy. And because I was at that time, that's the time I started to get suspicious of what all these people were telling me, challenging. Because I'd seen some of my friends, they got degrees. Were they happy? No, they weren't. They were working at a job, trying to save enough money to maybe get a car or something. Others, a little bit older, you know, had saved some money, and now they're looking for a partner in life, someone to share their life with. And when we get married, then we'll be happy. That was a big joke. When they get happy, when they get married, were they happy? No, they need a bigger house. So they had to save up all this money to get a nice house. And then what happened? Were they happy? No, then they got kids. And then they started thinking, oh, you know, when my kids grow up, another sort of 18, 20 years, then we'll be happy. And by the time your kids grow up, they have kids, so you're free daycare. So where will you be happy? Then when I retire, then I'll be happy. But then what happens when you retire? By that time you're so old that people start thinking. And I've seen this so often, that when I go, I've asked, you know, people from other religions, so in the churches, what type of people go to churches? They're all old people. Mosques, old people. Hindu temples, old people. Even Nolamara, mostly old people. You know why? Because they all think, when I die, then I'll be happy. And this, I started to wonder, how can you trust this? When I die, then I'll be happy. Are you sure? So this is one of the reasons why that you started challenging these ideas. Is it always the case that we sacrifice every moment so that sometime in the future there'll be some happiness which other people promise us we haven't really seen or experienced ourselves? Or has hardly seen other people experience such happiness? So I wanted to find out, you know, why are we doing all of this stuff? Is it really making us happy? And so, in order to find that quest, the insight into happiness and its causes, you know, you looked, and the Buddhism made a lot of sense, especially meditation. But then, I wanted to see some results. So it's not just theory. So I looked around when I was in England, in London especially, when I was a layperson. If I wanted to become a monk, where would I like to become a monk? And I didn't matter about traditions. What I wanted to look at is the smile on the teacher's face. Because I didn't want to end up like a miserable monk. So, why did I go to Thailand? It's because the monks I knew in the Thai monastery were the smiliest monks. That's why I went to Thailand. And of course, as soon as you saw an Ajahn Chah, wow, that monk was really happy. But you looked at him in many, many different situations when he was really challenged. And that was where, just no matter what seemed to happen to him, he'd always find a funny side to it. And when, especially when things went wrong, that was some of the nicest times, because that was really challenging. Ajahn Chah. And one of those stories which comes to mind was when somebody was possessed by spirits. You asked that question the other day, but I think it was at the time when, if I told a story, I'd go way over time. Have you ever seen anybody possessed, not by alcohol, but by real spirits? They're crazy, and they've got such incredible strength. And so I was there at Ajahn Chah's hut one morning, and a headman of the village, one of the local villagers, came up and said that last night one of the ladies in the village had got possessed by a spirit, and that she was they were dragging her to see Ajahn Chah. So could Ajahn Chah prepare for a visit of a really crazy lady? And it's really dangerous, because please excuse me, but this story, just to show how dangerous it was, there was another monk I knew in the north of Thailand, and you know, he always, you know, was made a bit of a reputation as being someone who could deal with cases of possession. And so he'd done many, many chants and whatever else he did to get rid of these demons. But one day, they brought this woman to see him, and she was mad, and big eyes and really violent, and the people held her down. And as he was doing his chanting, she escaped the grip of the men and lunged, and please excuse me, got her hands with the long fingernails on his private parts, on his testicles. And she wouldn't let go. And that poor monk, that was the last exorcism he ever tried. It was painful. Now you can understand, because monks wear, you know, we were like skirts, you know, not like trousers. At least trousers give you a bit of protection. But this poor monk, oh, he was in big trouble. So he never did that again. And so I always remember that story if anyone comes and brings somebody. That's really scary. But Ajahn Chah, there he was. And they dragged this woman to see him. And this woman, you could hear her, you know, shouting and screaming profanities, you know, a long way away. The gate of Wat Pa Prong is, I don't know, maybe almost half a kilometre or something from Ajahn Chah's hut. And these really strong villagers, you know, farmers, were really having difficulty actually dragging her to see Ajahn Chah, because when people have got that type of man, it's incredible power and energy. You don't know where it comes from. But anyway, they dragged her to see Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah straight away, "That's a very dangerous spirit," ordered the novices, "You, dig a hole, now, right here, quick. You, go and boil some water. I need lots of water and a bigger hole. Come on, work harder. Another you go and help him." So they dragged this woman up, and this woman was really crazy, lunging at him, swearing, and just really having difficulty holding her down. "Quick, we need a bigger hole. We need more boiling water." And that's why it's so amazing to be with someone like an Ajahn Chah. They're innovative like no psychologist and psychiatrist has ever done before. You know, somehow or other, you know, it was fascinating to watch, you know, Ajahn Chah's mind at work in the way that he expressed, you know, the solutions to very difficult problems. And I didn't know what the heck he was on about. What's digging a hole and boiling water got to do with, you know, possessions of spirits? But then, once the hole was almost big enough and there was enough boiling water, he said, "This is such a dangerous spirit, we've got to throw her in the hole, pour the boiling water all over her, bury her, and that's the only way to do it, because this is too dangerous a spirit, it's the only thing we have to do. Come on, more hot boiling water." Now the point was that Ajahn Chah just was so unique. He could have done that. Even I thought, "No, you know, you may actually do this." Throw in a hole and pour boiling water and over her. But certainly she thought he was capable of doing that. So what happened next? You can see that, you know, something went into her brain. "I better get my act together, otherwise I'm going to be scalded with boiling water and buried alive in a hole." And so in a case of a couple of minutes, she started to calm down. All her frantic actions started getting less and less and less, until she was sitting. The hole was almost dug, but not quite. There's lots of boiling water, but according to Ajahn Chah, not enough. But she was sitting there, exhausted. And Ajahn Chah just gave her the five precepts, which she took meekly, and they sort of carried her home to the village. And that was, wow! That was just so unique to see something like that. And don't you try it. But what actually Ajahn Chah would have seen is something deep inside of a person called the self-preservation, you know, the desire to be and not to be killed with boiling water and buried alive. That sort of, she saw that, and because Ajahn Chah was just a powerful monk, she thought, well, maybe that could happen. And so that preservation actually calmed down. It did something to stop the manifestation of, you know, what people thought was spirit possession. And so being around a monk like that was really interesting. You could see that he solved problems in the ways which wasn't by the textbook. It was something far deeper and some far more wonderful to actually to see the nature of human beings. And obviously it would work for that woman, wouldn't work for others. Which is one of the reasons why, you know, that our insight is not something which is stored in a book, like if this happens and this is what you should do, like a manual to fix a computer. It's something which is puts aside all that learning and is open, wise, in this moment enough to see what the problem is and to fix it just through the data of this moment and the way the mind can be just so innovative. In a way, it can solve problems when it is not burdened by the instructions of the past. So that's one of the reasons why you actually learn so much just by looking at an Ajahn Chah and see just how he will put aside conventional wisdom and react in such a way in these extraordinary situations where things were solved. So that made it very interesting to be around somebody who was both happy and wise, and you could check him out, and it actually worked. So that's one of the reasons why, that instead of wanting to be happy sometime in the future, you know, you learn how to be happy right now with whatever you're experiencing, and even with those sicknesses. And with those sicknesses that... I was only really sick once while I was in Thailand, and that was with typhus fever. There was a little bug, a little mite, which lived in the forest floor, which carried the typhus fever, scrub typhus. And because every one of the villagers had immunity, natural immunity over the generations, they never got scrub typhus, and in fact the health authority in that area said it doesn't exist in that part of Thailand. And it only meant the Westerners, the first Westerners to go out there, because we didn't have that natural immunity, we were the ones who caught it. It's like typhoid fever. And it took a while before they figured out what it was. And so when I presented with this really heavy fever, feeling terrible, they didn't know what it was because they weren't even looking for scrub typhus. It had the same symptoms as typhoid, so they treated it for that. But it was a very scary, because this was in 1975, and this was in the Ubon Hospital. Ubon was a poor part of Thailand. And not only that, this was a monk's ward. And the monk's ward, that there was maybe 6 beds on either side of this ward, and this was, you know, we're supposed to be the tough guys. So, as you know, you can imagine what it feels like, being really sick, not knowing what's going on, you've got a very strong fever and feel terrible, and you're in this hospital a long way from your home country, not knowing what's going on, and at 6 p.m., the night nurse vanished. So the nurse, they had a nurse's station, and the nurse vanished, just went home. And I was wondering when the night nurse was going to come. And an hour went past, hour and a half. Still the nurse's station was empty. And so I asked the monk next to me in the next bed, should we tell somebody the night nurse hasn't come? And he looked at me and said, what are you talking about? There is no night nurse. From 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., we're on our own. And if anything, any medical emergency occurs, it's just your bad karma. You know, Maybe I wasn't such a faithful Buddhist as I thought, because I thought, I want to go home. I want to go to a real hospital. So for 12 hours a day, there was no nurse. And when the nurse did come, I wish she hadn't have come. Because people have this idea that in Thailand, all the girls are nice and petite and pretty and soft. Not in the Northeast. Not in the nursing profession. Because this nurse who came in every morning and afternoon, she more resembled a water buffalo than a petite Thai supermodel. She was so strong, she had to be. Because she had to inject this cocktail of I don't know what twice a day, you know, in your buttocks. And she had to be, she didn't inject, sorry. Stab. Because these were the days you didn't have reusable needles, and they didn't have single-use needles, and they weren't high-tech and sharp. These were the ones that had to be reused. They couldn't afford a single needle, so they had to be reused, recycled. So I'm pretty sure they were used in Bangkok, first of all, and then the used needles shipped over to the provinces, and in the provinces used in the main part of the hospitals, and then last of all for the monks, because we were tough. That's what I felt, because it was like that. They were really dull. And so that's why, you know, if you tried to sort of push it in, it wouldn't go in. Stab. And even though I had lots of loving kindness, I was a very kind monk. May all beings be happy and well, but not that. What she did to me was terrible. Because your bottom was so sore, and here she comes again. But then of course Ajahn Chah comes along and visits you. Ah, my teacher. He was really, really busy, and I thought, oh, isn't that wonderful? He's come to visit me. And straight away, you know, when an unexpected visit like that comes, a lot of your pain and sleepiness and tiredness, exhaustion goes, and yes. And he came up to me, and that's when he said, absolutely true. He said, you'll either get better or you'll die. Bye-bye. He's a very busy monk. He didn't have time to ask how are you, what's going on, and the usual bedside manner. So he was certainly very happy and very straight to the point, but too much to the point for my liking. But it was so true, though. But because of all that sort of stuff which you learned over there, one of the reasons I want to tell this story was that on one occasion, I had about 3 weeks or 4 weeks in hospital, I don't know, feeling really, really terrible. So weak. I never felt so weak like that in my life. And I was very young at the time. To go to the toilet, there was only one toilet at the end of the ward. And so there was no one to help. There's no bedpans. So to get to the toilet, you had to somehow get vertical and then just almost like fall onto the next bed, grab onto the frame, maneuver yourself. Because all the lucky monks, they had the beds next to the toilet because you didn't have to move so far. And as soon as I got to that toilet, exhausted after about 20 minutes, then I made sure I did all my business because I couldn't afford to do that too many times a day. You're really weak. But then I decided just one day, so I've had enough of this, being weak. Come on, meditate. You can meditate. And so that's an amazing thing, what you can do. And I'm so amazed at sort of what you can do. You're just in a fever, really exhausted, after days with a sore bottom because of that nurse. And then just on the bed, and then just decide to close my eyes, okay, let's meditate. And you just go so deep into meditation that you can't feel your body. The body's vanished. Ooh. Now, if you think that your body vanishing right here, the hands vanish, the back vanishes, and you've got no perception of any sound or any feeling in the body, If you think that's very cool and joyful, imagine what it's like when you're coming out of the exhaustion, the tiredness, the aches, the pain of a fever after 3 or 4 weeks of typhus fever. That was just bliss. Ah, freedom. Your body felt just, well, you didn't feel your body, but your mind was just so liberated. And then after, I don't know how long, didn't have watch, didn't know the time, so came out afterwards. Oh, that was so wonderful. One of the first things which I noticed was my posture. Because from this day when people say, oh, you know, when you have a posture, you've got to sit properly. You know, just like the monkeys, right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, thumbs touching, back straight, chin down. That posture was just the weirdest posture I've ever seen. I had one leg over here, one leg over there, the body was twisted around, the hands were all over the place. I was in a fever in a hospital bed. And of course, your posture was really weird. And I've never seen that posture or that mood with the way you put your hands in any book on meditation. But it worked, because I got in a deep meditation sitting like that. That was one of the reasons it taught me by my own experience that posture is not important as long as you are comfortable. The most comfortable you can get under the situation. So you don't feel that you have to sit on the ground to get into deep meditation. On a chair is fine, bed, I don't care where you're sitting, as long as the body's comfortable enough to let it go. And the other interesting thing, which you can't be sure, but I really suspect this was the case, for that would have been the point the fever broke. Because when you get into those deep meditations, it's amazing what the body gets up to. It heals itself. Seeing this with other people, I was no too close to my own sickness and too young as a monk to really feel it for myself. I know that Ajahn Chah used to describe how he overcame his malaria fever, because that was the fever which almost every monk had in the early days. You know, it was a fever which forest monks had, because there were so many mosquitoes around and they would be carrying the malaria fever, so this is what monks put up with. And particularly in this case, Ajahn Chah was having a malaria fever, he told me. And again, just I don't doubt if he was actually sitting cross-legged, probably just laying down in his bed. And he said that he decided to just go right into the center of it. Go inwards. Just like you go into the lotus. He said he got so deeply in that he was in this cool part in the center of the fever. And he described it to me like it was in a forest fire, like the trees all around him were bursting into flames, but he was at the very center where it was cool. And he could perceive these flames were getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, but he was in the center and he wasn't burnt. And he stayed in that center as the fire got hotter and hotter, and then he said it exploded. And that was the last time he had malaria fever. Interesting way of overcoming these things through the power of deep meditation. But anyway, you don't do that to get rid of things. You do that just because you want to go in this present moment. If I was trying to get rid of the fever when I was meditating, there's no way I could ever let go of the body. I just went into the center. The center of now, right in this moment, right into this experience called now. And that is the doorway in, you know, to deep meditation. Not going anywhere, giving up that time, giving up that thought, giving up that measuring. As I mentioned earlier, that measuring always involves a past, present, or future. You measure from here to where you were, or from here to where you want to be in the future. And you can even just use your imagination. Imagine what it's like just being in this present moment, really in this present moment, no future, no past. How can you want anything? How can you judge anything? If you really take that present moment awareness to its its fineness, the most perfect present moment awareness. There is no wanting, there is no ill will, there is no guilt, no revenge, no anxiety, no plans, no hopes. The present moment is a powerful way of becoming free, going into this moment. And right in the present moment, it's impossible to say anything or think anything. You're too here to actually to go into descriptions. And lastly, the mind becomes so still. Nothing moves in the present moment until you just, these states of mind just evolve. So it's always this idea of going inwards, never on to the next stage of meditation. And to me, that is the meaning of insight. Looking in to this moment. What's in the center of this moment? What's in the center of this? What's in the center of the center of this? Always going in. And a worldly simile for that, which you know you might sort of understand, if you've been on aircraft, and on aircraft they show you the safety video, which you have to watch. And you're looking there in the screen on the back of the seat in front of you. You're looking at that as they start to say, your safety is important to us. That's what they keep on saying, it's our priority. I don't think that's the case. I think that their profit is the most important. So, there they are. Okay, got it. So, okay, I've already started. I haven't told a joke this morning yet. This is, here comes a joke. It's about this guy who was sitting in economy class and he was in the middle seat. And window seat, and it's only a small aircraft. In the aisle seat, there was a parrot. A parrot was sitting there. I haven't got to the punchline yet. She must know this one. And just after they took off, the flight attendant came past and said, "You know, can you give you any drinks?" And the parrot said, "Yeah, give me a whiskey, you bitch." And the flight attendant was just stunned. And the guy said, "Oh, can I have a glass of water?" And so the flight attendant sort of went off and brought the whiskey for the parrot. And he said, "About my glass of water?" He said, "Okay." But then in that time, the parrot had downed the whiskey and said, "Get me another one, you cow." Amazing, the language of the parrot. And anyway, so she goes off and gets another whiskey for the parrot and said, "You know, my water?" And at that point, the parrot has downed his whiskey and said, "And another one, you donkey." And so the man thinks, and when he comes back with another whiskey, he thinks, there's only one way to get a drink on this airline, and that's use a parrot method. So he said, "Can get me the water, you dog." And the flight attendant disappears and comes back, not with any more whiskey or with the dog, or with some water. He comes back with these two big flight attendants, male. And they grab both of them out of their seats. They open the door and they throw both of them out of the aircraft at 36,000 feet. And the parrot looks at the guy looks at the parrot, and the parrot said, "You've got a very bad attitude for someone who can't fly with their own wings." So anyway, back to okay. There was a guy sitting on the aircraft, and this time not a parrot sitting next to him. There was a guy and a dog. The dog was sitting there, not in the cockpit, in the cabin. He said, "What's this dog doing here?" as a security dog. It's trained to sniff out all sorts of things. So I'll show you how it works. So he sends the dog, go back into economy class. And so the dog goes into economy class, sniffs everybody, and it sniffs his backpacker and wags its tail, comes back and barks once. Wow. That fellow's carrying marijuana. He's got marijuana on him. We'll arrest him when we get to the destination. Let's see what else is on this plane. So it sends the dog up to business class, sniffs someone up there, and wags its tail twice, barks twice. Said, oh, that's the code, that's cocaine. She's carrying cocaine. Let's see what's up in first class. So it goes up into first class, finds this gentleman in a suit, sniffs him, barks three times, wags his tail three times. That's heroin. We've got a heroin smuggler over here. And then goes to another sort of part of the plane, over in economy, premium economy. And he goes in there, sniffs this other gentleman, sniffs him, doesn't bark, doesn't wag his tail, just puts his tail between his legs, jumps on his seat, and poos on his seat. What's that the sign of? A bomb. There's a bomb on board. Okay. Yeah. What did I want to start this airline joke for anyway? Airline story. Oh, yeah. Looking at the safety video. Now, one thing which I did notice, so when I first looked at that safety video on that little screen, that when I started watching it, I could see the upholstery on the back of the seat. But then as I focused on the security message, the upholstery disappeared. And I zoomed in, and I could see the plastic border of the screen, but then I focused in even further, and then I just saw the screen itself. The upholstery, the plastic border, all disappeared as I zoomed in. As I went in, things started to disappear. And that answered the question for me, just why I see people, they can watch videos on an iPhone, a tiny screen, and they really get into it. When I was young, I used to have these cinemas had a huge screen. And I've been on people's houses, they've got these huge screen TVs, massive TVs. But I can save you a lot of money. You don't need to buy those, I don't know, 3 foot, 6 foot wide LCD plasma screen TVs, whatever you call them. You just get a small screen. Because it doesn't matter how big the screen is, you only know how big it is when it's not turned on, when it's not active. It looks huge. But once you're actually watching a movie or the news or something on there, once you're watching Ajahn Brahm on one of the YouTube videos, whatever you're watching on there, your mind fits into the screen. And the experience is pretty much the same. Try it next time when you look at a video on your iPhone and when you put it on a bigger screen, say on your computer. Once you've actually zoomed in and your mind is fit into the screen, it looks the same. This is the nature of our mind. It zooms in to fit. So I've used that to avoid distractions of life. That's how you meditate when you have fevers and sicknesses. The sickness is out here somewhere. And you zoom in to the present moment. All the fear and the anxiety, I can't take this any longer. How many more days? When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? All that past and future, you zoom in to the center of this thing we call time. To now. And then the more you zoom in, the more the past and future just falls off the screen. Just like zooming into the TV set. What's on the outside, the edges, vanishes as you zoom in to where the action is. And if you keep zooming in to where the action is, say this present moment, you soon zoom in into silence. Now there is a problem here. Whenever there's a distraction, such as there's an ache in the leg, or you can notice, you know, the fever is getting hot over there somewhere, most people would actually zoom in onto the problem. They would zoom in onto the distraction. Example, you're watching the breath here, or you're in the present moment, zooming in, everything's going nice, and somebody bangs the door, bang. And what happens? The banging of the door comes to the center of your screen, and your breath in the present moment, they fall off. You zoom into the problem. So if you can remember when you're meditating, your meditation object, if it's a present moment awareness or silence or the breath, always keep that in the center of your screen. And other stuff, the noise, the heat, the aches, the pain in the body, keep that on the edge. Don't center on the problem, the pain, the noise, or the itch. Center just on, say, the breath. That which is going to take you in, further in. And that becomes a wonderful way which we call focusing. Giving importance, you know, to being in the center. And you can hear the noise over here. You can actually feel the fever over there. But you're actually going inwards. And as you go inwards more and more, the noise gets more distant from you. Yeah, you can hear it, but it's like a long way away. You can feel the body, the aches, the pains, but it's like outside a shell, and you're inside of it. So you're not getting rid of it, but you're going deeply into it. And it's one of the problems of human beings, that when we do have a problem, we want to go somewhere where the problem isn't. We're seeking for happiness in the next moment rather than here. How can there be happiness here when you have a fever? How can there be happiness here when you're dying, you've got lots of pain? How can you find happiness, you know, in malaria attack? You find it in the middle of the malaria attack, not somewhere else. You find your happiness in the middle of your cancer, not once your cancer is overcome. You find a happiness in the middle of boredom. Not get rid of boredom first, and then you can be happy. It's always coming into the center of things. Right where you are, there you'll find the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And that means that you can meditate anywhere, any place, no matter how sick you are, how healthy you are. Sometimes you don't have a choice. So you have to meditate like that. And it gives you this wonderful opportunity to be able to go inside of things. And when you go inside of things more and more and more, then you start to understand just how what we keep at the center, what we really think is important, that usually takes over. And if we think that the peace, the silence, the present moment is important, then that will eventually take over. And the distractions, the disturbances, they will disappear. And I have always like testing myself just to make sure that what I'm saying is not rubbish. Because I have to test myself, first of all, because sometimes it's so easy to fool yourself. So you test yourself, you know, is this true? So there was one occasion some years ago. It was a time when it was called the Saffron Revolution. I think the Burmese monks were protesting against the government at that time in Myanmar. And a group of the Burmese Buddhist community over here, they invited me to go into town for some protest. It wasn't really a protest, it was a bringing an awareness of what was going on in Burma. They said, monks don't get involved in politics. But they said, this is not really getting involved in politics. All we want you to do is come with us and sit meditation for 2 hours on the concrete pavement opposite Hay Street Mall, which was one of the busiest, noisiest places in Perth. And it was a challenge to sit for 2 hours in the middle of the city, on concrete, no cushions, for 2 hours in a very noisy place. I thought, well, that's a really cool thing to try. So then I went along, and it was even more noisy than I thought. because where we were sitting was right opposite a store which was called Time Zone. And Time Zone apparently was people playing video games with incredibly loud music blaring out all the time. And so I thought, wow, this is great. Let's see if we can actually, how to meditate for 2 hours in the middle of the city, opposite Time Zone, with all this stuff blaring out at you. And it's a test to see if what I teach others, I can teach myself. So it worked. Of course, if it didn't work, I wouldn't tell you. I only tell the anecdotes which have a happy story, happy ending. So there I was, and just, it was pretty easy. You just, you know, you're sitting there, you've got all the noise outside and the traffic and the people and the cold and it's, you know, stiff on your bottom. Well, some people do say, Ajahn Brahm, you don't need cushions. You've got your own upholstery. You carry it wherever you go. A fat bum. Your own upholstery. So, that's one of the reasons. If you're really thin and bony, you know, you're the people who should have more cushions. The well-upholstered people, they should, you know, just give up their cushions for others. That's what I always thought with Ajahn Chah and the senior monks of Wat Pa Phong. When I was a young monk, I was bony and thin. But they got all the fat cushions. I didn't get any cushion. And I needed the cushions more than they did. They got all the best food, and I was really all skin and bone. They didn't need all the best food. They're probably all arahats anyway. I was not an arahat yet, so I needed a nice food. It was wasted on them. So I always thought of other people that they're doing much better than me. And then eventually you do become a senior monk, getting nice food and getting even more cushions when you don't need them. And I think this is really unfair. I have to do all this work, sitting around talking to people all day. And all those young, bony monks, not well fed, they don't have to do anything. Sitting in the office, talking away, chatting away. They're supposed to be working. But I caught them in there telling jokes. Just before I came in here. isn't it the case we always think that somebody else is much better than we are? That when I get rid of this and become that, then I'll be happy. So that's it's a side issue, but oh my goodness, where did the time go? It must be going fast. Anyway, that was that time when I met these two Thai ladies, sisters. They wanted some counselling. You know why they come to monks for counselling? Free. That's why, it's because it's free. Good value for money. I don't know how much it costs with real counsellors. They get it for us for free. And, you know, it must be all right because, you know, they don't sue us afterwards for bad advice. So anyway, these two... One had a husband she didn't want, having a lot of trouble with her marriage. And I was giving all this wonderful advice on just how to keep together. You know, well, you're not so good yourself, you know, so you're a match. You know, be happy you've got a husband in your condition. Or something like that. Something inspiring. And then when it came to her younger sister... You know, she was one of these women, you know, she was, you know, looked okay and was charming and was just, but she couldn't find a husband. Every time she started a relationship, it fell apart within, maybe I think her record was 1 month going out with a guy. And then it all sort of, she really wanted someone to share her life with. She wanted a partner in life. And she couldn't get one. And to me, it was obvious. The solution. And you got your sister there, she's got a guy she doesn't want, and you want one. Your sisters, you know, swap, share. I can't understand why they didn't agree to that. But then anyway, eventually, then I got serious to the point. I said, you're the elder sister, you're married, you've got a husband, and you have what we call husband suffering. You're a wife. If you're a wife, you've got husband suffering. If you're a husband, you've got wife suffering. If you try and get rid of the wife, you won't have wife suffering anymore. you'll have single guy looking for a partner suffering. All you do is exchanging one type of suffering for another. Just like if you're poor. If you're poor, you've got poor person suffering. And if you, you know, make it to be rich, you'll have rich person suffering. It's not the same type of suffering, but it's still suffering. So many of the people think, okay, yeah, no, okay, I understand that, you know, if you retire, you get retired people suffering. All these people my age retire, they keep on telling me about their cholesterol count, their prostate, their whatever else they've got in there. That's all they talk about when they're old, the last time they went to see the doctor. It's old people's problems. But anyway, so many of those people, married, they've been wealthy, now they're poor, and they just, you know, what should I do with my life? They say, I can ordain, become a monk or become a nun. And it's true, if you become a monk or a nun, you don't have husband suffering, you don't have kids suffering, you don't have wife suffering, you don't have poor suffering, you don't have rich suffering, you have monk suffering. Or nun suffering. So you don't get rid of suffering, you just change the flavour. And then sometimes we think, oh, okay, when I become a senior monk, then I don't need to do all the hard work anymore. I can give all the talks. And when you're a senior monk, you don't have junior monk suffering. You have senior monk suffering. So have you ever noticed in life, we always change one type of suffering for another type of suffering. And it's not as if that once we pass that degree, then we'll be happy. We just have a different type of suffering. That's all. So those of you who are working, looking for the time you can retire, you have work person suffering. When you retire, you'd have retiree suffering. Those of you looking for a partner, looking to get married, you have single person suffering right now. When you get married, you'll have married suffering. Just ask any of the people who are married here. So, there's something wrong with thinking that when I get rid of this or when I get that, then I'll be happy. Instead, we stop looking in the future, we go inside this moment. And we say, I'm happy to be here. Old monk having to give talks, young nun having to do the chanting, all these things. When it's finished, this retreat, then I'll be happy. Have you thought like that yet? All the movies you're going to see, all the food you can eat when you go back to Singapore or whatever. Can you smell that evening meal you're going to get on Sunday evening when you go back? Can you actually almost taste it? It can sit in front of you. And if once you get anything, is this it? Of course. If you look for happiness in the future, it's not there. Happiness in the past, of course, is just memory fantasies. So the only place you'll ever find happiness is right in this moment, right now. That's one of the reasons why we don't strive to get somewhere else. Your whole life is strife. Strife means just pain and suffering. The country's in strife. We always think that striving, the verb which comes from the noun strife, just is a good thing to do. If you're striving, you're causing strife. So instead, we let go. We go into the moment rather than going anywhere else. And here, right now, is where you'll find amazing wisdom, liberating wisdom. Even sitting on a concrete sidewalk in the middle of town for 2 hours, just being blasted by rock music until you can't hear it anymore. Fevers and going inside. So don't go thinking of the future and packing your bags to go somewhere else. Stay in this moment. Enjoy every moment of it. Doesn't matter who you are and what you have. Go inside this rather than trying to change it. This is where you'll find the peace and happiness and the bliss. Not in anywhere in the future. Not in just dreams of a golden age in the past. dreams right now in this moment. That is where you find the liberation. Always going inside, never going outside. Going into the present moment, into the silence. And even the silence is just so gorgeous. Have you ever been into those really silent spaces, maybe here in this forest, or even further out into the bush, where there's not a human being for 100 miles in all directions? And it's just nothing moves. Silence is just one of the best healers, because the silence just gets inside of you. It calms your thinking down. It brings you into this moment. Silence is where things empty of noise and descriptions and allows the mind to go inwards as well. And in for the silence, the breath, inside the breath, the delight of the mind, the nimittas, the jhanas, all one inside of the other. Just like those Russian dolls, the babushka, one inside of another. Inside of another, inside of another. And the most beautiful is in the middle, right in the center of things. So that's one of the reasons why it's not about attaining, which is getting something in the future. It's more like learning how to be. Be so much in this moment that even the idea of being changes its nature. Go deep, 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 deep inside. Which to me is what the real meaning of insight to meditation is. Never looking outside this moment for your happiness and your peace. Never even looking outside this body. Yeah, I know a few of you are asking, can we please, please, please be nuns? You know, let go of this 50-year rule. Please, please, please. You just go inside this moment. Inside your body is a 56 or 55-year-old woman. Old man, inside that body is just the shell. Inside that is something which is timeless. But you go inside of that as well. Don't think that if you can become a nun, then you become enlightened. Right now, I'm in a status where I can't become enlightened. Never think like that. Right now, in this moment, go as deep as you like. Deep, 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 deep. Into this moment, always going inside. And there, just all those other distractions, all those other pains, just like the upholstery on the outside of that screen. After a while, it falls off your radar. You can't see it anymore. You don't know what time is. You don't know what day is. You don't know what your gender is, your age, your race. You go way inside your body. You can't feel its aches and pains. You go deep inside. And deep inside this moment, deep inside silence, you can't give anything a name. It doesn't deserve a name. You know, in the old days, they didn't have statues of the Buddha. They had like an empty seat under a Bodhi tree, or the footprint. The symbols, but not the person. Because, you know, when they say there is no Buddha, or rather, the one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. That's what the Buddha is, the Dhamma, the teachings. So I never had any image of that. Just something which signifies emptiness. An empty seat. Just a footprint with no shoe making that footprint. Just emptiness. Nothing there. As you go deeper and deeper into all these symbols, all these words, deeper into the silence, deeper into the joy. That's why it does become a happy path. The happiness does come in this moment, never somewhere else. And that's why it's a path which is easy, if you don't think about it. If you stop doing stuff and just stop. Sadhu. Sadhu.